This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more details, see jodcast.net.
Joining me now is Professor Marco Spaans from the University of Groningen, and your research is in quasars, particularly quasars in the early universe. Please tell us a bit about that.
Thank you, Nick. Current observations tell us that most galaxies that we see in the sky contain, in the very centers, a supermassive black hole. With supermassive, you should think of something that really is millions of times more massive than our own sun. Why these black holes are there is a big mystery. We know that they're there through their indirect gravitational effect on stars that orbit around these black holes and gas and dust that we can see. But why they have grown so massive, that is a mystery. Particularly when we look into the very early phases of the universe, what we astronomers often call high redshift. The redshift means that it's an indication for the expansion of the universe, and we see the universe expanding all around us. So if we go back to the very early universe, we see those supermassive black holes already. Now, that makes the mystery even thicker, the plot even thicker, for a very simple reason. When the universe was young, you have even less time to grow these things. In fact, when you see them now, the universe is about 13 billion years old, so a long time. But we see those black holes pretty much 100 million times as massive as our own sun already when the universe was only 1 billion years old. So when you thought you had 10 billion years, no, in fact, you only have 1 billion years. So one of the main aspects of my research is to understand why those black holes can grow as quickly as they have already in the early universe.
One question from me, which might be somewhat naive, but back in the early universe, the universe was somewhat more dense. Stuff was closer to each other. So perhaps, is it so surprising that you can grow something very heavy back in the early universe when the universe was rather more dense than it is now?
Indeed, Nick, that's a very good point. The universe, simply because the volume of the universe was smaller back in those days, the densities are higher. So it's definitely true that there is much more material available in a smaller volume than currently. Another aspect is that all the galaxies that are in the process of forming in the early universe are also closer together and may sometimes merge. So what can happen is that if you have a black hole in one galaxy and a black hole in another and those galaxies merge, then those central black holes, after a bit of time, they have to spiral into the new joint center of these galaxies, will merge as well. So while the black holes are individually growing in this denser environment, they may subsequently be helped by the very merging process that is much more prominent in the early universe.
All right. So we postulate that these supermassive black holes exist. What is the observational evidence for them?
There are a number of indications. If we look very close to home, the central massive black hole in our own Milky Way, we can observe basically in real time the orbits of stars very close to this black hole. In fact, one of the stars, S2 is its indication, orbits a central black hole in roughly a few years. So if you take a few snapshots, a few years apart, you can see this thing orbiting around a black spot of nothingness. But of course, you know, gravity doesn't work through nothing, so we can infer that there must be a very concentrated object around which this star is orbiting. Now that's close to home. If we go to galaxies a bit further away, we can still follow these stars, maybe not individually, but we can get a gist of how all these stars as a ensemble orbit around, again, a central object in such a galaxy. And then by carefully solving the Newtonian dynamics equations, we can get an idea of what the general orbits of these stars must be. And again, we can infer then that there must be a very massive object within a relatively small volume. Now, of course, we can think of many objects that in principle could be stable massive object and not be black holes, but sometimes you extrapolate. If you look at the volumes that these stars are orbiting around, it does appear that the only stable form of matter that at least we know about right now can only be a black hole. So not like a white dwarf or a population of neutron stars. It has to be a black hole.
It is the simplest solution to have, isn't it? The simplest theory to have a supermassive black hole at the center of these galaxies for everything else that we can observe, the motions of the stars that you mentioned, to be as we observe them, we must have a supermassive black hole. What's the connection with quasars? What is a quasar, first of all?
A quasar stands for QSO, quasi-stellar object. It basically goes back to the time when we, for the first time, saw objects in the sky that looked like stars, so quasi-stellar objects that had when you looked at them in more detail, it turned out, however, that their spectra were not like regular stars. So even though they appeared as stars in the sky, when you sort of looked at their light emission in finer detail, you saw that the different parts of the electromagnetic spectrum that were represented by this object were nothing like a star. The conclusion was then that they must be very, very distant objects. And at the same time, because they were so distant, this immediately meant that they must be intrinsically extremely luminous. Now, this goes back, if you think again about what I said about the redshift, these quasars can be observed and have been observed all the way almost to the dawn of time. The highest redshift quasar that we have right now is at what we call a redshift of 6.4, almost 7, and then the age of the universe is not more, and this sounds like still a big number, but it's not more than 800 million years. Now, again, if you would live 800 million years, surely this is a long time. However, the Earth itself is already 4.5 billion years, so imagine that. You know, this quasar was already there with its supermassive black hole, while the entire age of our Earth is a multiple in terms of time compared to this early phase.
We understand that black holes find it very difficult to emit anything. Certainly nothing is postulated to move from within the event horizon of a black hole. However, how do these quasars emit?
Indeed, Nick. What happens is the following. The pull of gravity attracts material within a certain radius of this black hole. As it moves toward the black hole, a very important physical quantity, like angular momentum, forces this gas, because it's mostly gas, bit of dust, and dust is a different topic, maybe we can discuss about this later, but imagine gas like hydrogen and helium moving toward the black hole, but because of angular momentum, you should think of an ice skater that slowly retracts his arms while spiraling, this gas starts to spiral into the black hole and settles into a disk. Now, this disk is what actually emits the radiation. So the black hole itself is very pitch black. However, this material on its way to the black hole settles in this disk, and as it moves around this black hole, friction between the different gas particles causes this disk to heat up to extremely high temperatures, easily a million degrees Kelvin, very, very, very hot, 1,000 times hotter than the surface of the sun, pretty much as hot as the center of the sun. When the gas is this hot, it can emit a lot of radiation, particularly X-ray radiation. So when we look at the sky, now this time not in optical light like when we follow stars, but in with X-ray telescopes, we can find, sometimes directly and sometimes indirectly, the X-ray emission of this accretion disk around a central black hole. And then again, by looking at this emission signature, we can infer how quickly this material must be accreting onto the black hole, because the faster the rate of accretion, basically the higher the temperatures are that you could reach.
All right, how many quasars do we know of in the universe so far?
So far, many thousands, and already dozens even in the early universe. Now, of course, it's easy to see things close by, and people often do what we call blind surveys. You just look at a piece of sky simply because you haven't looked at it before, and these things, again, these quasars are relatively easy to find because they're the brightest things out there. So often when you just survey a piece of the sky, these things naturally arise. And the quasars that we've discovered at high redshift indeed were initially done by an all-sky survey, where, you know, maybe one out of 100 object that they found wasn't really a galaxy, but was a core of a galaxy with an accreting black hole, and then we call it a QSO. But interestingly enough, now even in the early universe, we're getting so many quasars that we can statistically study their properties. Because imagine this, you have many quasars and you have them spaced out through time, from the early universe all the way to the present. Then you can study what is happening, at least statistically, because of course each object will be observed at a relative time compared to our time now on Earth. But still, if all these objects are intrinsically similar, obey the same laws of physics, and those laws of physics do not change with time, then by looking at the statistics of these sources through time, we can see how the average black hole in the universe evolves, how quickly it grows in mass. Maybe sometimes this black hole is sitting around doing nothing. Not all black holes that we see are quasars. Some of these galaxies have supermassive black holes, but there's simply no material to accrete anymore, and hence they don't shine as brightly as the others. And it's very important to understand what the so-called duty cycle is. So which fraction of its life is this black hole actually actively emitting like a QSO?
What are some of these general properties? Are older black holes bigger, smaller? What are the general trends that you can observe statistically, as you say?
Yes. Basically, what we find is that there is an interesting relationship between the mass of the super black hole, supermassive black hole, and the mass of the central part of the galaxy in which it resides. This relationship is nowadays called the Megorian relationship, initially discovered observationally by Megorian, and roughly it says the following. If you have a central part of a galaxy, and that central part you should think of something of the order of a size of 1,000 parsecs. It's like 3,000 light years across. And typically such a region can contain up to 1 billion stars. If you measure that mass, and you compare that mass to the mass of the central black hole inside this central region, then that ratio is about 1,000 to 1. So about 1,000th by mass of the central part of such a galaxy resides in the mass of the black hole. Now this is interesting because that size where all those stars are is so large that it cannot be a coincidence that this black hole knows about the central region in which it resides, or the other way around. Now, of course, the easy explanation is that it's gravity. All this gas that I spoke about that spirals into the black hole also spirals already into the central part of these galaxies. So out of this gas, we can also form stars. So the idea is, and this is going back to your question, what we think we are seeing right now, at least statistically, is that very early on in the universe, these black holes grow, but they grow coevally with the stars that form inside them. So basically, as you build up the mass of the central black hole, you also form all the stars that we now see in orbit around those black holes. And that fraction apparently is about 1 in 1,000 right now, and we do not yet have sufficient data to address the question whether this relationship, this Megorian relationship, also holds at much higher redshift. But the indications that we have so far is that it seems that maybe those black holes are already very massive in the absence or not in the complete availability of all those stars around them. So that they maybe grow before they grow all the stars around them. But this is still very tentative.
So we're not 100% sure whether the black hole grows in mass along with collecting the stars around it, or whether the black hole appeared first and accreted a galaxy around it, or at least the central parts of the galaxy around it. Yeah, that's fascinating stuff. Now, how do you actually observe these quasars? You mentioned that these quasars, the accretion disks around these supermassive black holes, emit a lot of radiation, a lot of it in the X-ray in particular. But how else can we observe them? I mean, do we have to have an X-ray satellite up in space to observe these?
Not necessarily. You can indeed see them in the X-rays. You can also see them in the optical. They emit strong optical emission, continuum emission, like the sun emits continuum emission. But sometimes you can also see them in emission lines, so very narrow spectral features, as we call them. If you take the electromagnetic spectrum, sometimes radiation comes out in small bands. We call those lines. There are particular lines of hydrogen that are very bright in QSOs. But a problem always with optical and X-ray observations is that the light that is emitted by these accreting black holes is emitted very close to the central black hole and hence has to make its way out of the galaxy. On its way out of the galaxy, it can be extincted, meaning that it is absorbed close to the black hole in the gas that is in fact being accreted by the black hole, and as it is absorbed, we cannot see it anymore. Now, what we can do is the following. It turns out that the same X-ray radiation that we sometimes see directly or indirectly, even if it's absorbed, we know then for a fact that the energy associated with this electromagnetic field is stored as heat inside the accretion disk around this black hole. This radiation can then subsequently come out in other wavelengths. It can be re-emitted by dust grains that are also orbiting this black hole. And in particular, it can come out in emission lines, but this time not emitted by atoms, but by molecules. Molecules, because they are more massive in a sense than atoms, they consist of different atoms, can emit radiation at much longer wavelengths, typically wavelengths in the far infrared and millimeter regime. Now, this is important because those longer wavelengths are not as well extincted by the gas close to the black hole as the shorter wavelengths are. So even though this is slightly indirect, we think we understand these physical processes extremely well, so we can then see the effect of the X-ray emission from the accreting gas as a fingerprint in the emissions of molecules, and you should think of molecules you know of, carbon monoxide, for instance, a molecule we all know. You can look at these emission lines and then not only see how bright they are and connect that to how much gas is being accreted by the black hole, but also looking at how these molecules are moving in orbit around this black hole to actually deduce parameters like what is the mass of the central black hole and how quickly is this gas literally in orbit around the black hole.
How do you measure the velocity of gas going around the central massive black hole in this method? But if let's say you see an emission line of carbon monoxide, let's say for the sake of argument, how do you go from that to measuring how it's moving around the central massive black hole?
If you have a line, you need to, what we call, spectrally resolve the line. So this radiation is emitted, but it's emitted in different amounts at different velocities, where velocity is, of course, always relative to our own motion. Now, we know the motion of the Earth around the Sun and the motion of the Sun quite well, so we can correct for that. But then all this gas is still in orbit around the central black hole, so we would see gas both moving towards us and moving away from us. Now, as gas is close to the black hole, it would be moving faster. So if you can not only spectrally resolve this line, but also spatially resolve the source, so that you look at this source and you can see how gas moves with a certain mean velocity far away from the black hole and what closer to the black hole, then you would have different measurements at different mean distances, projected distances from the central black hole, and hence you would see then what the mean motion is, the mean velocity of this gas as a function of radius. And then basically it's like observing the different motions of the planets in our own solar system. If you would have a number of measurements at different radii, you could then infer the laws of Kepler and basically deduce how big is the central mass around which all this gas must be orbiting.
Very good. Now, have we found any quasars which are only detectable through their longer wavelength emission, that we don't see them directly through their X-rays coming directly from the accretion disk, but from the heating of the accretion disk, the X-rays on the accretion disk, which, as you mentioned, then emits at longer wavelengths? Have we got any hidden quasars, so to speak?
Yes, Nick, in fact we do. We call these highly obscured sources. They're sources where the column of gas that is in front of the accreting material of the black hole is so large that we know from physical principles that all the X-rays must be absorbed. And in fact, when we look at such sources, we don't see any X-rays. Now, we have a measure of how big the column is through, again, these longer wavelengths. And some of these highly obscured sources, they're sometimes also referred to as ULIRGs, ultra-luminous infrared galaxies, because they're extremely bright in the infrared. Hence, in fact, that's how they were observed in the first place, in the infrared, again, at these longer wavelengths. Have no X-ray emission. And sometimes we're lucky. Sometimes these very bright sources are gravitationally lensed. And there is one case that is a quasar that's at a redshift of roughly 4, and the age of the universe then is not more than about 2 billion years. Because this source is lensed, gravitationally lensed, by an object that is between this source and ourselves, we are able to peer deeper into the center of this galaxy, because usually this light would be too dim to observe, but because of the lensing effect of curvature of space-time, we can peer into the central few hundred light years of this QSO. And lo and behold, when we look at how the carbon monoxide is emitting in the very central parts of this AGN, this active galactic nucleus, as we call it, we see extremely bright emission, much brighter than in our own Milky Way, much brighter than in other galaxies that form a lot of stars but do not have a very powerful accretion disk. So, yes, there are the first hints that these systems indeed are the way we think they are, highly obscured objects that are rapidly growing and feeding their central black hole. And, of course, the hope is that future observatories will allow us to probe much deeper in the past of the universe and find many more of these obscured sources.
Is it likely to be easier to find quasars in the manner that you describe, looking for their emission this indirect emission at longer wavelengths? Is it easier to find them at longer wavelengths than, say, through an X-ray survey?
In principle, I think yes, it is. Part of the reason is that if you want to observe in the X-ray, you basically always have to go up into space. And of course, to make a very sensitive detection, you basically have to have a lot of collection area. Yeah. Just like in the optical, if you have a big lens, you can focus more light and you can do a more sensitive measurement. So getting something up into space is always limited by the size of the mirror, as we call it, the lens that we can actually bring up into space. However, for the millimeter, we can also do observations on Earth. And in the future, there'll be a very exciting new telescope called ALMA, the Atacama Large Millimeter Array. It's in the Atacama Desert, which is in Chile, 5 kilometers up on a mountain to make sure that any water vapor that is still in that desert, and it's really a very dry desert, doesn't inhibit any observation, because water, of course, is very good in absorbing radiation in a millimeter, so we want to have as little water as we can. But if you have such a telescope on Earth, you can pretty much make it as large as you like. And ALMA, which will be operational in about 2013, only 4 years from now, will be able to make observations that are so sensitive that we, at least that's what we expect right now, we can detect these quasars at redshifts up to 10, so when the age of the universe is only 500 million years old, if they're really there, a matter of hours. In fact, you can look at a piece of sky with this telescope, and this telescope comprises, when it's done, 66 smaller telescopes, which together synthesize, as we call, a much bigger telescope. This is called an interferometer, where small telescopes talk to each other and basically make up a much bigger telescope. And we can, again, look at a random piece of sky, and our expectation is that if you look at a few square arc minutes, it's a relatively small piece of sky, you should already find a few of those sources. If you do this for a somewhat larger area of the sky, you should be able to find sources, like I described, with all these supermassive black holes, really growing. And because the age of the universe is so much smaller as you go more and more back in time, you see a relatively faster evolution. Because you know already now that there are massive black holes with masses of about 10 to the 9, about a billion times the mass of the sun. So these things, if they're already that massive, only a billion years after the creation of the universe, they must be growing extremely fast shortly before that. But things that grow fast must emit a lot of radiation, because all this mass goes into the central black hole, and on its way into the black hole, it must lose some of its energy. And it's precisely this energy that we believe comes out, at least for a significant fraction, in the millimeter regime, so that on Earth we can detect it quite well.
Well, this is exciting research, and we look forward to ALMA being operational in 2013 and you discovering thousands more quasars. What is the next step for you right now until ALMA becomes operational?
Well, next April, if all goes well, a satellite will be launched, which is called Herschel. It's a far infrared satellite, so it observes at slightly shorter wavelengths than ALMA, few hundred micrometers. This satellite has to be launched because, again, at a few hundred micrometers, the atmosphere of the Earth really absorbs all radiation that we're interested in. Now, Herschel does not have the same sensitivity, as we call it, as ALMA, but it will be able to observe slightly different lines. Particularly, it will be able to observe the carbon monoxide that I mentioned in even more highly excited states, so when the gas is even closer to the central black hole. So Herschel will not be able to resolve the QSOs the way ALMA can, but it may already find the signature of the warmest molecular gas close to these black holes, and then that could already give us better statistics on the not-so-distant universe. So Herschel will probably not be able to find things that are more than a few billion years back in the history of our universe. But first of all, that would already provide us nice targets to follow up on with ALMA, and it would definitely give us a confirmation or not, of the basic understanding that we have right now of what these accretion disks around these feeding black holes must look like.
Exciting stuff. So we look forward to those results when they come in. Thank you very much indeed for taking the time to talk to us about your research.
Thank you very much, Nick. It was a pleasure.